It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too.
Well, it's been a rocky few days. It looked to me as though my prime writing platform, the West Hitter Guardian, might be folding. Though that turned out to be thankfully untrue, the only editor that I have ever known there, and a friend, Hezzy Aarons, has resigned. We have a new editor, but all is well. In relation to this show, I've set up a GoFundMe site to try to ensure its ongoing sustainability, but as yet the response has been underwhelming. I need to publicize it more. My guest next week on this show is novelist, performer, and director of Chesapeake Math Program, Catherine DeSaro. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight is photographer, nonfiction writer, novelist, and public speaker, Sally Winograda. I first knew of Sally through a mutual connection with PC Magazine and its editor, Bill McCrone. Barbara McMullen and I had written quite a bit for it in the mid-1980s, including the cover story on the history and possible future of Apple Computer. As our connection with PC diminished, I became the regular columnist for Computer Shopper. Sally and her husband Daniel burst on the scene as PC's experts in the exploding field of digital photography. Since those days, Sally has moved in many varied directions, often in partnership with Daniel, and at times as the solo act. We'll explore all of this in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Sally, and welcome to the show.
Oh, John, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Philadelphia. I went to Friend Select, right on the Parkway of Philadelphia. It's a rather small Quaker school, and I was able to sign out during study hours to go to the Rodin Museum or the Philadelphia Museum of Art or the main library. So it was a very intellectually and aesthetically privileged environment.
Barbara McMullen grew up in Philadelphia in the Mayfair section of the Greater Northeast. Where were you?
We were. I grew up in Bala, and people now call it Bala Cynwyd, but Bala Cynwyd was two villages when I was growing up that were united by the U.S. Post Office, right outside of outside the city line. So I would take a train into Center City to go to school.
Okay, and when you meant the highway, did you mean U.S. 1 or did you mean the highway?
City line was U.S. 1 was the street that actually defined the border between the suburbs and Philadelphia.
Okay.
And it was U.S. 1, is U.S. 1.
And how old were you when you became interested in photography, and what was the impetus?
Oh, photography. I didn't know I was interested in photography. I was always interested in storytelling. When I met Daniel, he was a former war correspondent and current travel writer. I had a syndicated column in numerous city magazines, which started with Philadelphia Magazine and went to San Francisco Magazine. He had quite an extensive network. And he wanted me to travel with him. So he taught me photography. He was a former war correspondent photojournalist, so he had quite high credentialed photographic skills. And he had no idea I would take to it like a duck to water. I just fell in love with it, and we traveled all over the world, Antarctica 3 times in 4 years, the Amazon, Papua New Guinea, doing some amazing, meeting amazing people, having remarkable opportunities. And that was my initiation by fire in photography.
Well, I had a short time in photography that I gotten very interested in, and I was doing other things because while I was on Wall Street, but I had taken pictures at the local political club, and the woman that I knew that owned a bookstore asked me to take pictures at the graduation of her son and 25 other children from Hebrew school. So I went over there and I checked it out with lights. This was back in the film days, and she wanted to have pictures for the individuals and for their parents, as well as one for the newspaper. So I chose a fairly new film called Ektachrome that was a Kodak film that did both slides and and print. So I took the pictures, two rolls, and I sent them off to the lab. And I got this letter back from the lab saying that there was a 100,000-to-1 chance, but they've destroyed both of my rolls of film. And in the Riverdale section of New York, there was primarily Jewish. If you've ever had 26 Jewish mothers out for your blood, and people denying that. How do we know that you didn't write this letter? How do we know you didn't foul it up? And that was not much fun.
That's a terrible way to start.
you describe yourself as a storyteller, as you just mentioned, and your current American Hands project that we'll get to later is an example of storytelling through pictures. Were you interested in writing then at a young age?
Always. My mother was a storyteller, a natural storyteller. She never did it professionally. And so was my grandmother. And I used to just make them sit and make up stories for me, or sometimes tell me stories from their childhood, their life. When I would go to sleep as a very young child, my mother would read stories to me. She had to read stories to me, or I wouldn't go to sleep. And I would fall asleep in the middle of the stories, and then in my dreams make up the endings of the stories, and be very upset when she read me the true endings because they weren't the right ones.
Did you write in high school and in college for publication?
Yes. Okay. In high school, I had a remarkable teacher, and those people who new friends select know who I'm talking about. It's Teacher Margaret Sheets, and we used to call them by their first name, Teacher Margaret, but we had two Teacher Margaret, so she was Teacher Margaret Sheets. I came to friends. I was a friend select as a very young child. Then my parents put me into public school because I was in the main line, which was supposed to be one of the top public schools in the country. I didn't thrive there, so I returned to friends select later. So my first paper I wrote for Teacher Margaret, she was one of these steely-eyed, gray-haired ladies that you never, never want to cross. And when she gave me back the first paper I wrote for her in English, it had no grade. It just said, "See me after school." Oh, my goodness. My heart was in my stomach and my throat all at the same time. But apparently she saw something in me, and she didn't want to give me a grade. She wanted to just work with me. And she tore apart that paper and worked with me to put it back together again. And she did that with every single paper that I did for her for 3 years. And it was wonderful, wonderful experience. I eventually became the editor of the literary magazine for the school. And then I then I went into the closet as a writer in poetry and in fiction. I'm almost never out of the closet in poetry. I'm surprised I even mentioned that just now. But I went on to just write in my journal and not tell a soul. I just kept writing, and I loved it. Then I met Daniel, who was this very well-established freelance writer who made his living at it. And one day, coming home from an assignment we had in Hong Kong, he ended up with hepatitis. Now, this was when we were doing the travel column, and I was the photographer, and he was the writer. And he was in the hospital, and we were on deadline, and I don't believe in missing deadlines. Now, we had one of their very, very early laptops, and I sat down at his bedside in the hospital, and I wrote the piece. And the foolish editor accepted it, not knowing the difference between Daniel's polished, brilliant writing and my rather amateurish attempt at the time. Well, Daniel said, when he got well, if you're going to write under my name, I better work with you. So like Teacher Margaret, he tore apart my work and helped me put it back together, and at times he had me in tears. But he was a tough, tough editor, tough teacher, which, like Teacher Margaret again, is only respectful. It was saying to me, you have something, let's pull it out, let's get it right. At this point in our careers, that was quite a while ago, a couple of decades ago, I edit Daniel's work. We edit each other's work, and I'm very, very pleased that I had both Daniel and Dan and Teacher Margaret whipping me into shape.
How old were you when you met Daniel?
Oh. I was in my late 20s.
Okay, so you what did you do after high school? Did you go to college or something else?
I went to college. I thought I was going to be a doctor.
Okay.
But you see, all the women in my family were either doctors or housewives, and I knew I didn't want to be a housewife.
Okay.
Then there was one other woman who was very successful, and she was an actress. She was Hetty Galen was my aunt, and she was the premier female voiceover in television and advertising and animation. And since doctoring wasn't going to be my thing, I always loved singing. I thought I was going to be a singer, and I tried singing for a while. And the thing about singing, I was decent. I wasn't brilliant, but I was decent. And I was always ballads. It was always story songs. But the thing about singing is that unless there's somebody to sing to, it's, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it. It was a very lonely experience for me, artistically, creatively. So through that time, I continued to write in my journal, not understanding that's where I really belonged. And then I came home to Pennsylvania. I was living in New York City at the time. I came home to Pennsylvania. I actually opened an antique store, and I started telling people stories about the antiques. I just couldn't. I was always telling people stories. Why it took me so long to understand that was what I was supposed to do, I have no idea.
Where did you go to college? What did you major in?
I majored in pre-med at Muhlenberg College in Allentown. It's a small liberal arts school that's famous for its pre-med program.
Which is very close to where my daughter went to Lehigh. And
yes.
Well, she transferred to Fordham after 2 years, but it was an interesting thing that Barbara had applied for Lehigh. When she graduated from high school, and she was sent a note that her qualifications were excellent, but she obviously didn't understand that Lehigh didn't admit women.
Yeah.
And then
my
daughter went there later. So you graduated with this pre-med degree, and then you came
to
New York?
It was actually philosophy. I actually transferred to philosophy.
Oh, okay.
Which is part of... philosophy is very much an underpinning for me in everything.
There's another coincidence. I started as a philosophy major, and mm-hmm. and And then didn't check the New York Times. I noticed there weren't many jobs for philosophers. So I switched to something much more practical, English literature. So
right.
I was very lucky that I got to spend over 40 years in a technology field. It was just by luck.
So then
you majored in philosophy. And then did you go off to New York or did you do something?
Well, I actually, a friend of mine and I bought a very cheap old Rambler, a old car, put new tires on it and wandered the United States for about 8 months. And then
terrific.
I ended up in New York. It was
terrific.
Wonderful. It was a classic kind of on the road situation, and she and I had amazing experiences that most of which I still haven't told my father.
When you had the antique store, was that your stepping off point to meeting Daniel, or did that come later?
I had the antique store when I met Daniel. And he was a blind date. A cousin of mine was dating his colleague from Philadelphia Magazine. And I really wasn't interested in meeting men right then, but he was the most fascinating person I had ever met. And I couldn't resist seeing him. I mean, over the phone, he was just brilliant and fascinating. And every time I said, no, I'm not going to see this guy again, I just couldn't resist him, and within 3 weeks, he informed me we were getting married. I said, oh, yeah? That was the proposal, and that was the answer. Then he said, will you live with me until we get married? I said, why, aren't you sure? I moved in the next day. he also has a lot in common with you. He studied philosophy postgraduate at Cambridge University, phenomenology, and truly one of the most fascinating people I've ever known. We've been married now for over 3 decades. Now I've just given out my age, and I'm still learning new things about him, and he's still teasing my mind with new ideas and syntheses of ideas. It's fascinating to me.
As have Barbara and I was an officer of a service bureau of the Service Corporation, and I've tried to sell something to her firm, Beach and Company, and they didn't buy that, but she had to buy me. So a few years later, we were both with Morgan Stanley, and we decided to form our own business, and we were going to concentrate on mainframe financial data processing. And I happened to be standing by the elevator, and the vice president from the trading area said, oh, I understand you're leaving. And I said, yes. And he said, have you seen the computer on Ben Rosen's desk? And I said, number one, I don't know who Ben Rosen is. And number two, how can a computer be in his desk? So off we went to see Ben, who became a good friend, and he had an Apple II, and I said, gee, we ought to get one of those just to fool around with, and we went on our consulting business, and then 2 months later, the first spreadsheet was announced, and we wound up getting training people and bringing us all over, and then they asked Dan Brickland, one of the authors, to write an article for the now defunct magazine Popular Computing.
Who is, by the way, my cousin.
He's a terrific person. He's just a
very
wonderful
distant
guy.
Cousin, but a cousin. Yeah.
So he said, we don't do that, but you should ask Barbara McMullen to do it. So they called up, and Barbara did the article, and from then on, we both wrote, and eventually I became the prime writer, and she does all my editing. But like you, we knew we wanted to work together. We weren't going to each take new jobs. Prior to your hookup with PC, you placed articles in a number of well-known publications. Tell us about some of them, and what were the subject?
Well, if I could just diverge for a moment, another similarity to you. in my antique store, Daniel had a Selectric when I met him, and I coveted that Selectric because you could type corrections. It had that whiteout right in it.
Right. We had one of those,
I really wanted that. And so in my antique store, somebody walked in with a Trash 80.
Okay.
The original TRS-80 Radio Shack computer.
The Model 1?
Model 1.
Okay.
And I traded a bunch of silver coins for it and gave it to Daniel so I could get the Selectric. And when he was a book critic and investigative journalist and a former war correspondent with this very incisive critical eye of things, and he saw this and he started analyzing it, and that is why he ended up being a contributing editor at Computer Shopper initially for Stan Veit. And then
Stan was one of my closest friends, and we were about to launch a new business. We were already into the web magazine when he passed away.
A sweetheart of a man. Oh, did I love Stan. Anyway, so that's, you know, when you talk about how parallel our lives are, I think the more we get into it, the more parallel it's going to be.
Now, you mentioned he was a war correspondent. Was he in Vietnam?
That's the one war he wasn't in, although he wrote a marvelous novella about a Vietnam vet called Honor. He was in Biafra and Bangladesh and Northern Ireland, among other hot spots.
Okay. My closest friend, or my oldest friend, was Newsweek's Saigon correspondent during the war. I mentioned that prior to hook up with PC, you placed articles in a number of the well-known publications. Tell us about some of them. What was the subject of the pieces?
Well, you see, it's such a variety. I'm trying to keep it simple. There were the travel stories, of course. That went into places like Islands Magazine and San Diego Magazine in San Francisco and The Rob Report and Lear's Magazine. I mean, a lot of those kinds of publications, glossy mags.
Okay, let me ask this.
Yes.
Go ahead.
We even had a column in Stars and Stripes on travel. Then we also... of course, Daniel was a book critic, a National Book Critics Circle, so he also did that, and I helped him a little bit with that, but that was not with my byline. I just would help edit that and put in my 2 cents when I disagreed with him.
Let me ask you specifically about Liz. Was Nelson Aldridge the editor then?
Yes, Nelson. You know Nelson?
Yes, I spoke to him a number of times. I had one of the worst experiences of my writing life ever, writing for Liz. My oldest friend I mentioned before, Kevin Buckley, was the founding editor, but he left before they published a magazine, and the New Yorker New York Magazine had a, someone had leaked to him, Kevin didn't, about Kevin and Francis lived arguing in the halls, and Francis said, "What do you mean? I can't change quotes. It's my magazine." So so that didn't get along very well with him.
Daniel knew Nelson from the time when he wrote for him at Harper's.
Okay, well, I knew him through Kevin, but they had called me to it was home computing was just starting to be talked about. And they called me, and they wanted me to write something about computers coming into the home. So I talked to Apple and to Tandy, who had a home computer, and to IBM that had just introduced the PC Junior. And we talked about the whole idea of time shifting, which people really hadn't written about how now you could, just as you could time shift your dinner with the microwave, you could do that with a computer. So I wrote this article, and I called Jim Canavino, who was very high up at IBM, and then Ed Kroll, who was the vice president at Tandy, and someone from Apple, and who was also rather high up. So They sent me a draft about a month later, and the whole thing was totally different. And it was one of these buyers list about prices and all this stuff. And I called up Irate and I said, "How could you do this? This was," and she said, "Only interviewed men, and we want a women's thing. We wanted to talk to women." So I was furious, and I called Kevin, and I said, "What do I do?" So he said, "Is anything under your name?" Because it was all under my name, and I thought it was the Chintzy article. He said, "Is there anything that's incorrect?" And I said, "No, but it's not." He says, "Cash the check." So that was it. So that was the end of that. So how'd you hook up with PC, and tell us about your long relationship with it?
Okay. I just drew a blank on the name of the editor, and that's very embarrassing.
It's probably Bill McCrone.
No, it isn't Bill. It isn't Bill. There was an editor. Oh, I'm going to kill myself at 3 o'clock. It doesn't matter.
There was two. There was Mike Englehart, and it was Paul Summerson. They were the co-editors under Bill.
No. I'm talking about a staff editor. Anyway, we had become known as tech writers. We had been writing for Macworld about photography and popular science. I think we actually did one of the pieces we did for Lear's was about computers. Daniel had been a contributing editor, a computer shopper. And I was at Comdex one year. Daniel and I were at Comdex one year, and you remember Comdex preceding CES. And it had been a very, very long day. And there was this big press event and no seats. And I was exhausted. And there was this one guy who was stretched out on a booth, taking up three seats. And I said, "Excuse me, I need to sit down." And we started talking, and he had a major problem that he had a scanner story to do, and he had no idea how to test scanners. He needed somebody to write a test script for scanners. I went, "Aha, here we are." And that was the first piece we did for PC Magazine, and they were very pleased. And we kept writing about scanners and printers and things, kept nagging Michael Miller, saying, "You need to do a story about digital photography. It's the hot new thing. We really know it. Just set us loose." And he'd say, yeah, it's not that big. Okay. I reminded him of this at a party at Robin Raskin's last month. You know, nobody was interested at PC Magazine about digital photography. But then one day, he called us in and said, "You know something? Microsoft is late on a piece of software. I have a 10-page hole in my magazine. How quickly can you do a roundup testing what digital cameras are out there?" Well, the digital cameras that were out there, there were six cameras, two of which were the same. The Kodak and the Apple QuickTake were the same camera. And we quickly created a test bed. The film camera that we tested it all the others against for image quality was the film in the box, you know, the cardboard film in a box?
Right.
With the plastic lens, and it still whooped all of them. But it was a fascinating experience, and we got a major piece done with all testing within a week and a half, and they were very impressed. It was solid testing. And so we became their digital photography experts and imaging experts. They actually trotted us out for their PC Magazine University to teach around the country, do seminars. And our seminars outsold everybody else's combined. That includes Bill McCrone's and Dvorak and Bill Howard's. The ones we did on digital photography and imaging just outsold everybody else's. But when I said to Michael, "You know, the field is wide open. Let's start a digital photography magazine." He said, "Okay, give me a proposal." So we wrote up a proposal, and the advertising department said, "There's no marketing for this. Who's going to be the advertisers?" I said, "Mercedes is going to be the advertisers. You know, Rolex is going to be the advertisers." They didn't get it. They didn't do it. They would have owned the market because nobody else had that kind of magazine at that point.
staying with digital photography, obviously, you know, one of the things that I write about is how people make poor business decisions and creative disruption about how the technology changes the whole world. And one of the things that I point to is if you walk around the mall and if you say it's usually under the radar, and if you say, "Gee, didn't it used to be 2 music stores here and 3 mm-hmm, and 2 film processing stores," which there obviously aren't. And but we've been through this transition where digital photography, number one, killed the film business, and which was the major reason that Kodak, that developed the digital camera, didn't push it right from the beginning because they knew it would kill the film processing business. But we're in the second wave now that the smartphones have more or less taken over the whole photography market, other than the very high end. Did you see that coming, or do you disagree, or do you?
For hobbyists, I agree.
Okay.
And there is a problem with that, in that memory pictures, those pictures that you're going to want to have 20 years from now, people won't know where they are.
Right.
The pictures of the baby's first steps aren't going to be available. I'm the family archivist, and I have boxes and boxes of pictures from my grandparents and my parents and my aunts and uncle that, you know, we can look at, we can pick up those pictures and look at them, and I can show them to my father and say, "Who is this?" And he can tell me stories without any technology. Even if they are uploading the pictures from their phone to their computer, forget about cloud, you know, but to their computer that they own, that computer is not what they're going to be accessing 20 years from now.
Right.
And those memory pictures of the baby's first haircut and of that prom date and all those wonderful memory pictures, the impromptu ones, are going to be gone. And there's going to be generations of people who won't have those.
Now,
that's very sad.
Now, does the market understand that, though? Is this still a place in the market with the average person for the kind of photography that you're speaking of?
I think they love, that's what the photography is about. That's what they want to take pictures of. Do they understand those pictures won't be there? I don't think they're thinking about it, because our world has become very much immediate. Now, that's what matters. If it takes you longer than 140 characters to say something, you've lost them already. A lot of they feel, "Oh, I put it up on Facebook, it's safe there." They're going to be gone. And do the people realize it? I think some people might, but it's also too complex to take these digital pictures and keep on upgrading the technology of them so that it'll work with the new computer that you get this year and next year and 5 years from now and 20 years from now, to be able to constantly upgrade your storage. I have heard people industry conferences, every 2 years, I'd say, somebody speaks about how really film would be the best archiving if we just had film prints.
Now, we went through a period, I remember, that with even with cheap film cameras, that people at weddings, they'd put 10 film cameras, 10 of those cheap cameras on a
mm-hmm.
on a table, and they'd hope that you'd take pictures and that you'd have them develop, or you'd send them the camera back. And do people still do that? I haven't been to a wedding for years. Do they still is this still a market for those cheap cameras?
I don't think so. I think they're great, but I don't think so. Also, where would you get them developed? It's more and more difficult to get film developed.
So you're saying that despite your misgivings that the game is over for film, for the average person, anyhow.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And all my fine artwork, I use a very large, I use a medium format camera. So file management for me is quite heavy. But all my fine artwork is digital also. I have my old Leicas. I sold my old Hasselblads. Actually, Daniel has my Leicas out right now to sell. And it's breaking my heart. But I haven't used them in well over 10 years. It's silly for me to hold on to them.
Yeah, I have a press camera, and I've got a 3x5, and I have probably probably more Minolta equipment than a camera store, and as you say, I haven't used it. I don't even use my standalone digital cameras anymore, and you know, it's a quick picture, and obviously the advantage of that is that there's a jillion things in public record that wouldn't have happened before. The person walking down the street and can see the cop beating up on someone, or someone robbing a candy a candy store, and all of a sudden they have those pictures. So that's
very
obvious,
true. Yeah.
Obviously one advantage.
No question about that. If you go into the political and social environment, digital photography does have major advantages. We also lose a lot of privacy. We can go into that discussion too. There is still a place for a standalone camera, but it's for people who really care about the photography, about creating and not just snapping. Photography is a thoughtful process involving composition, light, shadow, color. It is a creation, and it takes it's a combination of both the inspiration that you get from the snap shooting, but also of making choices, creative compositional choices, so that you put yourself into the picture, into the composition. And that does require a standalone camera that has f-stops and shutter speeds and good, great lenses. My exhibition work, I'm creating pictures that are 40 inches by 60 inches. The detail of work that I can get into them, the quality, a really good lens, a really good camera that can give me some amazing, amazing detail that I can work. There is a place, but it's for people like me, or even for serious hobbyists like me who love photography, who love the art of photography.
I remember coming home from work and being beat from a week on Wall Street for working 60 hours, what would I do? I would stay up all night printing things in my kitchen with my with my enlarger and my paper and my, you know. And I had a wonderful time.
Oh, yeah. Daniel had created a dark room for me when I was starting out. It was a black and white with a gorgeous lights enlarger, the most exquisite lens. And I would go down into the dark room after dinner and just keep going and not come up again until breakfast.
Yeah, that's what I do. That's what I do.
It was magic. It was absolute magic what you could do there. I had a similar thing happen on Photoshop 1.0. I was up in Camden, Maine, the Kodak Creative Center for Creative Imaging. It was a wonderful education complex that Kodak had established in Camden, Maine, just at the very, very beginning of digital photography. And we actually were there the week before it opened. But then we went back, did a story for Popular Science on it, I think it was. And I did the same thing. I just stayed up two nights in a row. I stayed up for 3 days, just fascinated by what Photoshop could do, what I could do with it. A lot of people feel that Photoshop is just about perfecting the photograph. It isn't. You perfect the photograph by creating a great photograph, but then you can take it further, just as you did in the darkroom, but even more so with collaging and with there's just so much with dodging and burning and typography. I love using typography on my pictures.
Therein also lies a problem. I remember when I was very young, an ex quarterback for the Cleveland Browns, George Radiman, was running for elective office in Kentucky, and all of a sudden these pictures came out of him in bed with a scantily clad woman, and they were able to prove that, number one, that he was given a Mickey, that, number two, that the pictures that were taken and then doctored in a dark room. And it was a big deal then. Now, in the age of Photoshop, there were pictures going around the internet of Bill Clinton with his arm around Monica Lewinsky, standing in a full dress outfit with his fly open and his member exposed, and it looked real. So in the days of Photoshop, how can you trust pictures the way that it used to? And you say the pictures were 1,000 words.
When I was working in film, I could control what a picture said by how I took the photograph. Let's say I was on an assignment for Islands Magazine. So it's, you know, for glorious, beautiful, exquisite island resort. I would compose the picture a certain way, and that would tell that story. But if I were doing an expose for, let's say, Mother Jones, maybe I'd just turn my camera slightly, compose it showing the garbage, the trash heap in the back. Photography has always been an incredible propaganda tool, as writing has. What we create always has to be looked at with a critical eye. Always.
The other thing that you've probably looked at that I show my classes and I can't believe it is stenography, where we can hide pictures behind photos, that we can hide files behind digital photos. And and there was a rumor that was never verified that the 9/11 guys had passing instructions back and forth in encoded by PGP, but they were hiding them behind porno sites where you wouldn't think any good Muslim would go to look. But so here you're even using photos to hide things behind them, and it's very difficult for people that are trying to find these things to know where to look. So.
What this all leads to really is the issue of teaching critical thinking. In this internet age, people accept surface level information without checking their facts, without using common sense filtering very often. More and more, Daniel was an investigative journalist. Very few publications are giving the time for real journalism. They don't have the money, they don't have the staff, and apparently the public isn't interested in knowing the in-depth stories behind the headlines. They read the headlines. I really feel that this is one of the things we have to do in schools, is teach critical thinking, critical analysis of what is thrown in front of you. If you're sitting at a diner and somebody throws a slab of meat covered in a lot of gravy on your plate, you ask what it is. You don't just eat it.
But they
don't do that with information.
That's absolutely true. And in the course I teach a course called Communicating Quantitative Information. And the students have to know enough statistics to be able to understand them. They don't have to do their own statistics, but then they also have to be to analyze stories and to say, number one, do the statistics fit? Do they prove the point? Should they have been shown in a graph or the table? Because we forget numbers in about 30 seconds. And one of the examples that I use, the New York Times had this story about 5 years ago, I guess, that the glass ceiling in New York had been broken because women now earned the higher average salary than men in Manhattan. And that was as far as the story went. It didn't point out that more women, on average, have college graduates than men. It also didn't point out that women tended not to take the very low paying jobs like busboys, and that if you did a comparable job, that women at that time made 76 cents to the man's dollar.
Exactly. Yeah.
But this was in the New York Times, and you know, and then you have to tell students. There was another one that 100 people in 10 years who had tried to hold up banks and stores in New York City were wearing Yankee hats. And they made a big deal of this. It was actually Slate magazine that tore this Times article apart. And they pointed out that in the same time period, there were 100,000 holdups. And how can you point to 100 people and say it's because the Yankee fans? The point they were making is that more Yankee fans than Met, there were more Yankee caps than Met caps. But the whole thing is that we're not digging down and we're not questioning things. So you're absolutely, I agree with you totally. In the same time frame that you got hooked up with PC, you also started Digital Benchmarks. But the audience can find this aspect of your life at www.digitalbenchmarks.com, all one word. Tell us about Digital Benchmarks.
Well, actually, it started because we created the test scripts for PC Magazine Labs for cameras and for image analysis and for image editing. We also created the scripts for image quality. And when we left PC Magazine, we decided that we wanted to take these scripts and put them on steroids and really, really do some in-depth testing, which we did. Again, magazines aren't interested in in-depth work so much, so we'll often do it as private consulting for companies wanting to know the competitive how their product holds up against the competition or other issues like that. We'll do white papers. We do technical due diligence, those kinds of things. But it started out with those test scripts and making them go even more in-depth.
And further in the same time frame, you and Daniel published a whole raft of books on digital photography.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of them.
Well, we wrote the first major book on digital imaging. It's called Digital Imaging for Visual Artists. It is a Manhattan phone book size book, if anybody is old enough to remember phone books. It's fun. A lot of people, major names in the industry, will come up to me and say, you know, I first discovered and learned about digital imaging from your books or your lectures. So we did that one, and I was at the time a chapter president of ASMP, American Society of Magazine Photographers back then. Now it's American Society of Media Photographers. And I had a lot of photographers very angry at me for writing this book, and, you know, they were very threatened by it. But those who didn't, I told them, if you don't start embracing it, you're going to be out of business, and they were the ones who didn't embrace it, unfortunately, some very talented photographers. We also did the Digital Imaging Dictionary, that was a fun one, except the language kept changing on us. It was so frustrating. Down to the very last moment, we were changing, adding definitions. It's the kind of publication at this point really belongs on the web, but back then it went into a book. We did a book about eBay photography. That was a lot of fun. And again,
I was going to ask you that. How did that book sell? And is it still current?
Is it still current? Not really. No, it isn't still current. But Griff from eBay Radio calls us periodically to interview us about ideas on how to photograph different products and cameras and stuff. We still talk about it occasionally. We did very well with that, mostly because of the seminars we did that were very, very popular back when... that was a number of years ago. We did a lot of seminars around the country about that, and as well as about photography. And we did two PC Magazine books on photography, one on photography, digital photography in general, and one on DSLR photography. And that was fun, too.
I know from experience that no matter how encouraging publishers are, they wind up doing little in promotion and marketing. How much time have you and Daniel spent marketing? Then have you found any particular approach to be successful?
Oh, that is the big question, isn't it? As a woman who is in the middle of checking the copy editor's edit of my new novel that's coming out in a little bit over a month, I'm asking myself the same question again. The rules keep changing. Back when we started, publishers really did do some things for writers, even mid-list writers such as ourselves. Mid-list writers, we're the kind of writers that are just reliable, that they know they're going to get good stuff from, and that the public knows they're going to get good stuff, but we're not the big names. We're not the Stephen Kings. We're not the Hillary Clintons. We're just the backbone of publishing, essentially. And way back when, there was some publicity done.
Very little,
publishers.
Though. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but still
yours
some.
Okay.
But it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And now they only want to publish you if you have a quote-unquote platform. Well, I have a platform, but it's still not. The rules keep changing. Is social media the answer? To a certain extent, I think so. Developing a persona, developing a following is important. Right now I'm focusing just on making sure the book is the best it can be, and you just have to trust. My last novel, JoJo, did not sell tremendously, but it seems to be an evergreen. It was a Jewish Book Council Network book. I had some wonderful speaking gigs on it. Continue. I just got a call for another one on it, and it's gotten great reviews, and it does seem to be an evergreen. People are still buying it. So what the new publishing business means that the book doesn't have to fly out the gate as big. It has to be something that can keep going for a long time because it can be published forever.
Right. It's not going to run out. Sure.
Right. Right.
I remember years ago, three of my friends, one couple and another person, they both wrote books for Simon and Schuster. They mm-hmm. both had the highest profile editor at Simon and Schuster. One, that same fellow, Kevin Buckley, wrote a book on Panama, the whole story. Then he had gone down and interviewed Noriega before they put Noriega away. And, and the book began with a box being delivered to a family, and a big box. And they opened a big box, and it was the head of the father of the family, Hugo Spadafora. And the book read like a novel, and the New York Times gave it one of the best reviews of a nonfiction book that I've seen. And they had the book party that Adolph Green's apartment and all sorts of people there. The other book was The Hack and Crackdown by John Markoff and Katie Hafner. And I did some review of it early. And that was also very good. But they were advised to get their own publicist. And Kevin did not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kevin was on an FM station in Washington, D.C. I happened to be there and I heard. He was also, the closest that he came to New York, was on a radio interview from Albany, whereas Markoff and Katie did get their own publicist. They're on a Today Show. They're all sorts of places.
Oh, my.
So it was very frustrating for them.
Yeah.
You know, but
the problem is, of course, there are a lot of people out there preying on authors today. Very few publicists who hang out the shingle really produce, getting the Today Show or whatever. The biggest money making in publishing today is scamming the author. There's a lot going on there, and with seminars that you pay thousands of dollars to learn how to get a bestseller, and
right.
It's very frightening to me to see all these people with their dreams, and they're being hurt by it. It's very wrong. Publishing is never, ever, I mean, authors, let's face it, I've been a freelancer my entire life. I have been very lucky. Daniel and I have paid off our home. We live comfortably. We are never going to be rich. We never expected to be rich. Never, ever expected to be rich. We expected to live a creative life where we could produce books and pictures that were meaningful to us and to our readers and our viewers, and that is all we can ask of it. There are people who believe that all they have to do is write one great book and they'll be on Easy Street. It's baloney. Publishing has never been a place where the real author, except for maybe a Stephen King, makes a lot of money.
But even if you're Stephen King, you write because you want to write. I mean, he had 22 of 23 novels rejected, and he also wrote, by the way, the best book that I've read on writing, Stephen King.
Yes,
on
very
writing.
Good book. Yes,
terrific
yes.
books.
Yeah.
But they write because, and I write because I want to write, because I have to write.
When I'm not writing, any day that I either don't write or don't work on pictures, I forget who I am. I lose myself. I am fully me when I am working on one of my creative projects. I am fully alive. I am constantly growing as a person and searching. And I never find real answers. I'm just constantly searching and redefining my questions and throwing it out there to open up discussions and maybe synthesize new ideas. But it's because I'm driven to do it. I have to do it. I lecture often young artists and young writers, and the first thing I tell them is marry someone with a pension and health insurance, which, of course, I did not do. And then the other is I tell them, learn how to be plumbers. Because then if you're a plumber, nobody argues with your fee. They got water on their floor. They're going to pay you whatever it is. My nephew misunderstood me. He became a nephrologist. But the thing is, we do it because we have to. And those writers who can do other things, who don't feel that compulsion, shouldn't be writing.
Go ahead.
Because the passion isn't there, the need isn't there, the compulsion to really do the best, to keep sculpting, to keep making it better and better. It's like the difference between a snap shooter and a photographer. One is a creator, the other is someone who just simply says, oh, that's pretty, snap, and walks away. writing is the same. It's opening, as Red Grange says, it's sitting at the keyboard and opening your veins.
Red Smith, not Red Grange.
Red Smith, excuse me. You're right, Red Smith.
Yeah, he's, terrific quote. Terrific quote.
Yeah.
And if you're writing nonfiction, I am for my weekly column, I have to be constantly learning. So it's pushing me to understand what I want to write about. So I say, let me write about that because I could use some more understanding. I saw a quote when you mentioned be a plumber from Joan Rivers today saying, you can make more from getting married than you can from a lifetime of work. it was her advice to women. And then on to the 21st century, where you expanded into even more areas. Let's start with the best known, the American Hands Project, which received great press from Senator Pat Schroeder, who called it the global treasure, and earned you a standing ovation on the floor of the Pennsylvania Senate. That must have been heady. Tell us both about the project and also how you got to the Senate.
Well, American Hands is narrative portraits of people who keep the old trades alive, such as a glass blower, spinner, rug makers, bookbinder. It's hands as a metaphor, not just photographs of hands, but portraits of people at work, in their workshops, creating the things that were needed by our developing culture. And it is the story of who we were as a culture and who we can become again. In this digital age, we need to stay connected with that skill that we have of making and creating that is well far beyond zeros and ones. How I got to the Senate is really cool. I was invited to have the American Hands exhibit in the East Wing Rotunda of the State Capitol Building, which is a heady experience to begin with. And my local state senator invited me up to the gallery above the Senate floor, and I had no idea what it was about. And then suddenly they're announcing who I was, and there was a standing ovation, and oh my goodness, it was wonderful. At this point, I'm not the quantifier, Daniel is. He's kept the numbers for me. At this point, over 350,000 people have personally attended an American Hands exhibit. Very often it's in very small venues. I've gone to tiny libraries, community libraries and small schools, also university galleries and museums. I don't care. Wherever somebody wants the story, I will bring it because I think it's an important story for all of us to keep alive and keep those skills alive because we're going to need them. The problem solving and the creative thinking that is behind what we can do with our hands. It's very important. The website is amhands, amhands.com. I'm constantly taking pictures. I welcome invitations to exhibit and speak, and I'm always looking for more subjects.
Give that website again, please.
Amhands, amhands.com. As American, hands.com.
Got it.
And also, by the way, my master classes, information about my master classes in photography, imaging, and printing are on that site also.
In the same period, you also had the Wordsmith Project. So please tell us about that.
Oh, the Wordsmith Project. That was fun. That had its big exhibit at Book Expo in New York in the Javits Center. For a while there, I was creating interpretive portraits of people behind the scenes in book publishing. So somebody like Barney Rossett, who was the publisher of Evergreen Review, and he fought the censors for all of us, I got to spend a whole afternoon with him when he was about 92. And
wow.
I was told that, I was warned, I was told, you know, Sally, he's something of a curmudgeon. He's going to throw you out after 5 minutes. I said, I'll take my pictures and run. he wouldn't let me go. After about 4 or 5 hours with him, I had to say to him, I'm sorry, Barney, I had to go to my next meeting. I was late. But he had stories to tell me about his photography of the Spanish Civil War. And
wow.
He was telling me about when he brought the Henry Miller books over here and he had to fight the censors about it. And his son's name, first name is Beckett, after the author whom he published, who became a good friend of his. He showed me the Freedom of Information Act binders on his in his bookshelves that took feet and feet of his bookshelves of what the government was keeping track of him in the 60s. He was just a fascinating man. So those are the kinds of things I did. I'm looking right now at the portrait I did of him. I call it, the title of that one is Literary Pugilist, because he did fight everybody for us.
It's great to talk to people like that. I've run across a person just in a neighborhood church who published Isaac Asimov's first book.
and we talked
to him about that. It's just terrific, you know?
I met Isaac Asimov at the rollout of the Collier's CD, the Collier's Encyclopedia CD. It was the first, It was the first encyclopedia on a disc. And he never came out of his apartment, but for this he came out. And he said, I've lived to see my three major predictions come true: a man on the moon, the Great Library, and robots. And he was pointing to the CD saying, this is the Great Library.
I heard him speak once, and also I've talked to people who he wrote, as you probably know, The Sensual Man by M.
Yes.
He had a reputation of a dirty old man around young women, too. Who knows that?
Well, a lot of them did.
And then it was the radio show that you and Daniel set up. How did you get into that?
Arts and Letters. Well, like you, we know fascinating people, and we want to meet more. And so this is just very recent, Arts and Letters. We're using Google Hangout technology and recording it to YouTube. And we talk to people. I was just setting up to talk with Lawrence Shun, who's this marvelous writer. He's a science fiction writer and a psychologist. He does the amazing Conroy series. It's wonderful. But we've also spoken with Mika Halpern, who is he's just one of those. He's actually one of the few conservatives that I really love talking to, because he's so bright and he isn't dogmatic. He's actually a thinker, and I love talking with Mika. But we talked about, believe it or not, kosher wines, gourmet kosher wines with him. Spoke with, I'm trying to think of some of the wonderful books, Kelly McMasters, who wrote that wonderful memoir about growing up in the area of Brookhaven, nuclear reactor
sure.
Long Island. We have photographers, writers, thinkers, philosophers, anybody that we're fascinated by. We'll just we used to schedule it, then we discovered people weren't tuning into the live show, that they were more interested in just getting it on YouTube. So we just do it whenever we can schedule it with people who are fascinating. And we're having a wonderful time with that.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And then finally, at least for the time being, your foray into fiction. I know that Daniel had previously gotten into the genre and even set up the fictional Poconos town in Pennsylvania. What led you into fiction and also into Daniel's town?
Well, that's, first of all, I've always loved writing stories. It was coming out of the closet as a fiction writer, because I always was there, writing stories, telling stories. Having spent my life writing nonfiction, I was always writing other people's truths, and I was getting tired of that. I decided it was time to write my truths. So I the way I can write my truth is by exploring ideas and questions and create that within a fictional world. What I'll do is I will, it starts with a character. Someone is born full-blown in my head with a name, a personality, a history. That person is there. I can't change that person. But then I put that person into very bad, awkward situations, and it's there comes a story. How did I get into Daniel's world? Well, Black Bear, Pennsylvania, we live in the Poconos. And a number of years ago, as I said, we've always been into story. We started playing a game. It was a literary folie à deux where we created a town, sort of inspired by our town, but not quite. And we started peopling it with the crazy ladies from the kennel, the dog kennel, and the fire hall politics. And it was just a fun game we played. Then one day he wrote this, well, not one day, but one year, he wrote this exquisite little novella called Honor, about a man racked with guilt over what he did or didn't do during the Vietnam War era. And he said it in Black Bear. And it was just an exquisite little novella. And then about a year later, I was walking along, and Judith Armand was born in my head. She is a mixed-race Jewish woman raised in the Poconos. And immediately I knew that she lived or was raised in Black Bear. And I stole some of Daniel's characters, built on them, expanded the geography of the town a bit. And I could go further into JoJo, but it's essentially she vowed never to return, and she comes back about 20 years later to bury her grandmother, get rid of the family estate, and never return again, as far as she was concerned. During that 1 week, she sits Shiva for her grandmother, runs into the white boy who broke her heart, the bully from her childhood who promises worse, and uncovers a secret that makes her question the nature of the prejudice that created who she was as a woman. And so it's a story of prejudice and preconceptions and the racial ethnic divide that haunts our society. But that was set in Black Bear. And so now Daniel is writing a story about the Volunteer Ambulance Association called Black Bear One, and he is stealing some of my characters, and he's doing something with my Rabbi David that I'm not happy with at all. But I have no say. Once the character is in his bailiwick, I can't say anything about it. As long as he remains true to who Rabbi David is.
Now, are both of your novels set in Black Bear?
No. My new novel is called The Winter Boy, and The Winter Boy is actually set in a never-win society. It comes from the same kind of heartache that drives me. I don't understand why we hate, why humanity hates, why we war. In JoJo, I did it on a very personal level of prejudice, personal anger, and the downward spiral of prejudice. The two-edged sword of prejudice. In The Winter Boy, I try to create a world. It's speculative fiction. The reviewers are calling it literary speculative fiction, in which a group of women band together to create a society, create a world that is built for peace and not for war. And, of course, they fail because we are human, and I am, as much as I am a dreamer, I'm also a realist. And also, there's no plot if they make it, if they succeed. And it's a story of one of these women with what they do is they train the young men who will be leaders using, well, frankly, storytelling, sex, and reason. There's no magic. The only magic comes from human relationships, and it's a bit of a thriller. It's what is called slipstream. There are science fictional elements. There's fantasy elements. and there's thriller elements in it.
I'll have to read it. The I had good talking about prejudice. One of the guests I had maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago was Susan Brown Miller, and she was in Mississippi as one of the freedom riders when the three Jewish lads from New York were killed, and just seeing the people non concerned about this and everything, you know, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Then she got heavily into feminism, and she wrote Against Our Will, that was considered a very important book in the feminist area.
Mm-hmm.
But just
mm-hmm.
it seems that the whole Black Southern experience was all so much of it was what we unfortunately have called white trash, and it was people thinking, well, I'd really be down, but at least I'm better than those guys, you know. And it's the one upsmanship that's very, very important to us, and the only way that we can be one ups if we say, well, the Palestinians aren't, you know, of the same level that we are, or the Bosnians aren't, or whoever. And we also tend to forget how long did some of these things, they go back. You know, for instance, I'm sure your husband knows from his Bosnian experience that that we expected when the Iron Curtain went down, all these guys would be jumping up and down and democracy and hooray, and they started shooting each other right away.
Yeah.
Over something that happened in 1600, you know. I mean, wow.
Yeah, in the Winter Boy, in this novel that's coming out in November, I talk about the subject that, and this is a fact that in many primitive languages, the word for us, for my tribe, is human in my language, and the word for people outside is animal, and it's okay to kill animals, to slaughter animals. Whenever you can no longer think of the other as a human being, the other as a mother or a father or a son or a daughter, you can kill without caring about them. The need for empathy is so strong. It's amazing. But then there's another character in Winter Boy that poo-poos all this and says that some people who are so irrational. And how do you fight irrational violence with rational empathy?
Well, we also, I think that you're right with the first. I remember years and years ago during the Vietnam protests, one of my favorite writers ever, Pete Hamill, wrote a column about one of the protests, and he agreed with the protests. He was anti-war, but he said one thing, he hated to see these young people calling the police pigs. He said, once you dehumanize someone, once you make them a gook or a wop or the sheeny, you can do things to them. They're not human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And
that,
and we have to get over that. Now, if that was 40 years ago, and we still haven't gotten over that, you know?
Well, it's worse now. The tribalism has gotten much, much worse, as far as I see. I am on Facebook. And, by the way, I invite people to friend me on Facebook. I enjoy it. It's Sally Wienergrata. And I did one of those apps where you do a mosaic of all your friends. I was very, very upset. I was very upset by it because I saw...
You went off. Sally dropped off. I don't know why. Let's see if we can get her right back. Sally, please call. What did I drop off? God. Please call back. Okay.
back.
All right, I'm trying to get to her to get right back. In the meantime, what I haven't gotten into is how did she and Daniel collaborate, that I find very interesting, being married to a person that works with me, and I'm in the process of reading Joyce Carol Oates's very, very poignant memoir, The Widow Story, and in it she mentions that her late husband Ray. I've never read any of her many novels. Barbara does all of my editing with me, and or she edits everything that I write. And I just find it hard to understand how that if you collaborate in so many things, you're not able to do that. Let me see if I can get Sally on the phone as I talk now. Let's try it. One. She's come back in.
What happened? I got lost.
You dropped in, and all of a sudden you were gone. I was just calling, but thankfully, your line's busy.
Hello there. I'm sorry that happened.
I'm not sure of the that it's worse now, or it's more hidden. I mean, when we were young, people thought nothing of using objectionable terms to relate to other people. Now, and businesses found it very easy to only have white Anglo-Saxon Protestants working for them. Now you can't do that anymore. So
that's
at least
true.
Some of the prejudice has gone underground anyhow.
Mm-hmm. But we still are congregating among our own. It's comfortable. I continued talking after we lost connection, so I don't know if you heard the part about the essay I wrote about staring into the mirror, where it's just easy to be with your own. It's challenging. It's difficult to listen to people who may not agree with you. But as long as the discussion, the dialogue is respectful, it's so good and it's so energizing to talk with someone who has other viewpoints, other experiences. It's just a lot of people find it much more comfortable to be around with others who have the same points of reference.
Well, in some cases, also you can learn so much. I mean, when Obama said that he had the same trouble that Florida kid had, that mm-hmm. you don't understand until you look at the statistics that people are stopped because they're walking while black or they're driving while black.
Yes.
Because if you've never had that experience, you don't understand it. You don't understand
mm-hmm.
why would you always be looking over your shoulder, and why don't you trust because I'm white? Oh, well, that's a story, but I'm not like that. Yeah, well, prove it to me, fella. You know, one
yeah.
of those deals.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, the first thing we see is race. No question about that. And it's everybody. If you're black people have told me the same thing. The first thing they see is whether a person is black or white. it is what we see. Then we determine, okay, are they, we listen to their voice. Where are they from? Do they sound literate? Do they sound stupid? Do they sound liberal? Do they sound conservative? Do they sound Christian? Do they use the right, do they use the tribal buzzwords that we like to hear?
Yeah, well, before we went on the air, I mentioned that I had taught a course in an online text-only course years and years ago, 1993, I guess, at Marist College, before the World Wide Web and Facebook and all these other things. And it was because people that were in the graduate program had been transferred by IBM to different parts of the country, and they had to have the one course to complete, and we wanted them to, since it was supposed to be the capstone course, to be an actual capstone to what they had taken at Marist. And they would have had, they had to come to the campus to present their papers to a conference. But one March morning, when I started the course, we asked people, how was your week? And this one fellow in Austin said, gee, it's gotten very hot. I was out in the yard yesterday afternoon, and boy, am I brown. And the fellow in Raleigh said, I'm always brown. Mm-hmm. And this had never come up. They were able to get past this and get right into each other's personality, their intelligence, their interest in a particular course. And if we could constantly do that, we'd be well ahead of the game. But obviously, with graphics, we're not able to.
Right, right, exactly. In JoJo, that's one of Judith's problems. She is the only black in the community. She also happens to be the only Jew in the community, and it is one of the
maybe one of the only black Jews in Pennsylvania.
No. Quite common. I know a lot of people don't understand that, but it's quite common.
Okay.
Every temple has blacks in them that I know.
Okay.
Anyway, it just makes it difficult when you are an outsider anywhere. And you start seeing the world very differently through the outsider's viewpoint. And it's one of the issues that I felt important, compelled to explore in my fiction.
Well, it's even in our common history. I mean, if you go to Leviticus and you read about what they're supposed to do to their enemies and to other people, I mean we have that just as much as some of the groups that you hear about and you think of as being barbaric or whatever. You know, it goes all the way back in human history, no matter where you came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. I feel that what we have to do is just it's one of the lectures I give called try to do it as a seminar. Sometimes people book it as a lecture of crossing the racial ethnic divide. We need to just allow ourselves to accept the fact that we recognize the differences. I see the man in front of me. He is black. Fine. I see that. Go beyond that. You know, accept your own preconceptions and go beyond them. Try to find out what is underneath there. Try to allow that other person to find out what's underneath you. In social media, for instance, was I off when I started talking about that?
No, you had talked about doing one of the collages, and you were very surprised, and then you stopped.
Yes. This was a few years ago that the vast majority of my friends on Facebook were white Westerners. It is different now, thank goodness. But back then it was true. And what I've tried to do, I've tried to keep my Facebook presence, my social media presence open to all comers. As long as you speak respectfully to me and to each other, you are welcome. I want to hear the different ideas. I want to know the different experiences. I want to have dialogues and conversations that explore other ideas. If I'm very opinionated, and I will post liberal, feminist comments and stories. I don't care if somebody brings in a patriarchal conservative viewpoint, as long as they do it respectfully. I mentioned Mika. He isn't on Facebook with me, but he is a conservative who speaks intelligently and with respect for all others. I love those conversations.
I think at times, from my experience in talking to people, it's not only going beyond with one person. I've known so many people who will say that Charlie Brown is a good guy and he's a hard worker and he's this. And then 5 minutes later, they, meaning the whole group, they're lazy or they're cheap.
Right.
And I remember reading a sports story by Roger Kahn back in about the Boys of Summer, and he mentioned this very good third baseman for the Brooklyn Dodgers coming up to Roger and saying, "I'm going to lose my job because of the nigger." And Roger said, "Who you mean, Robinson?" He said, "No, not Jackie, Junior Gilliam, the rookie." You know, it was that this guy was okay, but it was the others weren't. And I've seen that in many cases, you know. And you confront a person with it, that maybe more of them are like him than you realize. Very often, they're not open to that, you know. But
It's hard. It is, because it takes energy, it takes commitment, it takes discipline to be always stretching outward. Stretching beyond who you already are, what you are used to. It is very, very, very comfortable to be, for me, it's very comfortable to be around women who have a same intellectual bent and similar kinds of backgrounds, and we can just talk and know what the other is really meaning. It is comfortable. It's no growth, but it's very, very comfortable, and it's fun, and we can really enjoy each other. But it's like writing, it's like photography, it's like anything that means something. It takes work, it takes sweat, it takes stretching beyond what is to what could be.
Yeah, I was very lucky, because things hit me early. I remember when I was very young, they made a big deal that this Archbishop of New Orleans, Roman Catholic Archbishop, was integrating the churches. Then a guy named Leandro Perez was picketing, and he got excommunicated for his troubles. But my immediate thing was, so what? Where have they been for the last 100 years? I mean, if you believe in the message of Jesus, then it wouldn't have happened to begin with, you know? And that was really beaten into my head, because the neighborhood I grew up in, it was this Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood, and there were a few Italians and a few, and it was considered fun to throw things back and forth, and we had these names, and it never bothered people. We also heard the names about black people, but there weren't any in the neighborhood, so I didn't know any. It was any worse than being called a Mick. And the first time I ever went out of my neighborhood, I went to a Catholic school track meet, and I was just 11. I was either 10 or 11. And it was this, and I was standing on line to get a Coke, and it was this little black kid, must have been 7 or 8, jumping around and throwing things and all this, and finally he stepped on my foot. And I pushed him out of the way. I said, "Get out of here." And about 5 minutes later, or 3 minutes later, he came back with his brother. And I had heard about these big brothers who would stick a knife in you or kill you, and he walked up to me and said, "Did you call my brother a nigger?" And I said, I kind of gulped. I said, "Yes." And he said, "You're a Catholic and you should know better," and turned and walked away.
Good for him.
If he had beaten the hell out of me, all I would have learned was look for the big brother. But from then on, I did know better, you know. And and he was just so wonderfully bright. I remember him now, you know, 50 years later, you know. But it was
good
just
for
wonderful.
Him. Yeah.
On another topic, you and Daniel have collaborated on many things, while you also both have produced individual work. I'm reading Joyce Carol Oates' very poignant memoir, The Widow Story. In it, she mentions that her late husband, Ray, never read any of her many novels. Barbara McMullen and I had a technology consulting business for over 25 years and obviously worked very closely. While we now teach different courses to different colleges, she proofs reads and edits all my columns as she did my novel and book of collected poems. I'm possibly the worst type in the United States, and I, of course, can't proofread my own writing. How do you and Daniel collaborate, and does the collaboration extend to your individual work?
Yes. Nothing goes out of this house to an editor until one of us has edited it. That's individual work. I just sent out an essay that to a publication that I don't want to go into. They're publishing it, but he edited it before I submitted it. After they accepted it, he edited it, and I sent it off. Always. But also, we brainstorm together. I'm sitting here looking at the notes from the copy editor on my new novel, The Winter Boy. And I have to reply to them and see if I agree with them and get the manuscript delivered at the end of this week. Well, we have this wonderful studio in an old Oddfellows Hall, so it's very much loft space in the country. So Daniel's desk is about 20 feet from mine, and I will swivel my chair around and say, now she says so-and-so, do you agree? And then I go back. Constantly. We will argue over split infinitives. That's our biggest arguments in our career, in our marriage, has been over split infinitives. Other people argue about trash. I do not like split infinitives, but even so, they do have to exist in some dialogue because people use them. And Daniel has convinced me about that over the decades. But I'll also, he has all this wonderful experience as a war correspondent, and he also was, he followed the munitions, the international munitions trade as an investigative journalist. So when I had to write about some armament in my novel, in The Winter Boy, I sat down and brainstormed with him, what kind of armament is appropriate for this society? Blah, 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 blah. How did they go about this? Hand-to-hand combat. I brainstormed with him about that. We're constantly brainstorming. We go for walks along our stream and have these fascinating conversations that people dropped in on them, they'd wonder what this is all about. But I find it fascinating.
So you do everything. Yes, as we do too.
Yes. Yes. It's a 24/7 marriage. We're with each other 24/7. It's rare when we're not together.
We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and very productive life. What else might you like our audience to know about Sally Winograda?
Oh, my goodness. I guess we've covered it. I'm available for speaking. I do give master classes in photography and art. I'm an editor, but we won't go into that because that's unimportant. I mean, compared to everything else. Everybody come out and buy my books and support American Hands. One thing about American Hands I'm very proud of, the New York Foundation for the Arts adopted it under their fiscal sponsorship, so it's now officially a nonprofit. Daniel says it always was nonprofit, but now donations are tax deductible. So that's that was very exciting to have that imprint from one of the most respected arts organizations in the country. And come visit me at grotta.net. I do blog there irregularly. Come visit me on Facebook at Sally Wiener Grotta and buy my novels, JoJo and The Winter Boy. Oh, The Winter Boy's on the e-books are on pre-publication discount right now.
Oh, they are? Okay.
Yeah, it'll be published November 6th, but the e-book, there's a special deal on all the sites.
Well, lots of luck with it, and thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a delight, John. I look forward to meeting both of you and spending a lot of time chatting. I think we have just too much in common.
I agree. And the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, johnmack13.com, for the URLs to previous shows, schedule upcoming shows, and the past to the GoFundMe location to keep this show going. Tune in next week for Catherine Bassaro. And until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silva. Whoa. Steady, big fella. Steady. Thank you again, Sally.
It was delightful. I love your choice of music. The intro music, too.
Come on, end it.